Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/news-ad-free. That's amazon.com/news-ad-free to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Where am I at? I'm a crisis. I'm many, many things without knowing which one is more real than the other.
Because it's time. It's time for reparation.
The only thing I have in common with this character is that she's black. This does not look like me or sound like
me. I'm sick of being a side Indian character.
It's like, it's a form of cultural imperialism.
How are you supposed to feel that exploitation is the best you can get?
LGBTIQ rights are black rights. We have always been here. Black queers, we will always be here.
Welcome to Race Cut. I'm your host, Ahmed Yusuf. And joining me today is Yasir Morsi. But before we begin, we'd like to do an acknowledgement of country. We acknowledge the Kulin people as the owners of the land in which we meet, and we pay respects to the elders, past, present, and future. This land was never ceded, and the process of colonization, occupation, incarceration, genocide that began over 2 centuries ago continue to stay. And Yasir Morsi is a lecturer in politics at La Trobe University and author of an upcoming manuscript, Radical Skin, Moderate Mask. Hey, Yasir.
Hey, Ahmed.
It's great to have you on the Race Card. And I guess what I want to talk to you about is, like, we know you're a lecturer, basically. We know you're an academic, but who are you? Like, in more of a sense of what made you get into this field, in a sense, because I know a little bit about you. You grew up in a secular home, and your conception of Islam was very, very base level up until university, right? What was that upbringing like?
Well, firstly, thank you for having me. And to answer your first rather philosophical question, who am I? I'm a crisis. I'm many, many things without knowing which one is more real than the other. But yes, in respect to my deen or Islam, it has been flows and ebbs, ups and downs, confirmations and negations. I've rarely held a grip on it. I have a fundamental commitment, if I can use that word, to Islam. I don't have a discomfort with its central tenets, but of course, in its abstract religion, is one thing, in its lived experience and its concrete everyday realities, it's an altogether different thing. And living in the Muslim community in this particular time is both testing and rewarding, but almost always punishing.
What's that like?
You'd know just as much as me, right? I look back and ask myself, why did I decide to study politics? Because it's just a site of continual aggression in the kind of politics that I deal with, which intersects between...
What do you mean by that aggression?
You always seem like you're fighting. You're fighting for either your voice to be heard, you're fighting for a group or people's survival, recognition, or in a sense fighting to overcome certain institutions, one of which is the most dominant, racism, or you're just fighting for other Muslims to recognize their own, you know, social ills, be it patriarchy or racism within the community. There's very little respite. And of course, with Islamophobia being what it is, everything's under the microscope, and there's so much at stake, and very few people can take, you know, to use an analogy, it almost feels like you're constantly wound up, and it's hard to breathe again, you know. I forget. I'm not saying this is the case for everybody,
yeah,
but it's...
Well, actually, I guess what I want to talk about that in that sense is, like, I know you as a scholar or a critic or whatever that means, right? Mm. There's a quote you shared with me about being in exile. And I guess in that sense, is your existence sort of like that
right now? Yeah, I've never really felt at home anywhere in that sense, in the exilic sense.
What's that like?
Well, again, I think it wouldn't be much different from your experience, because when you're here in Australia, or you're constantly having to justify your position, your locality, your supposed loyalty, your level of threat, your proximity to liberalism and democracy, your understanding of whiteness and what it means, you know, a performance of whiteness, not even just an understanding it, because mostly you can't say it out loud. In that sense, you're always catching up. You're always trying to belong. And it's not that you want to belong. It's not. It's just that belonging comes with certain privileges that you seek, such as security. Then on the other hand, you know, when you're in certain spaces that you can call Muslim, they become overtly conservative. They shut the gates. They want to protect some authentic understanding of their religion. And, you know, if I go back to Egypt, where my family is from, I stand out. Not because people there make me stand out. It's just, it's not the place I grew up in. And, you know, whether it's my broken Arabic or whether my unfamiliarity with the places, I just don't feel at home here or there. And in one way, to tie back to your first question about being a critic, I think in many ways that's a suitable place to be in exile, to continually travel in between.
You talked about there briefly about when you go to these places, it's not like where you grew up from. So how was growing up? What was that like?
You know, I write about this in my book. For example, when I was younger, I went to do my prayer with my granddad, right? And Allah yarhamu qiddis siddiq took me, and, you know, it was a big day. It was like, you know, my grandmother put some musk on my wrists and, you know, rubbed her hands on my shoulders and made a dua for me. You know, it was a big day. Yasser was going to pray Jummah, and the family wished me farewell, and I was becoming a man. I was just a young kid, of course, at the time, and I'd go to the mosque, and it was a strange place. It was like, you know, it was the khatib, or the one preaching the sermon, was yelling, and I barely understood Arabic, right? And I'm looking around to gain some sense of familiarity. I'm looking at my grandfather, and you know, and then when it came time to pray, when the second when the Akama came, you know, it was then, the second Adhan came, then it was like, okay, now what do I do? And I just imitated what my grandfather was doing. You know, I just followed the moves. And I remember saying, assalamu alaikum, one shoulder into the next. And this, I was very young. No one taught me anything. I mean, but this is what I mean. I was imitating what I thought it meant to be.
So you were sort of performing a sense of religiosity.
Yeah, and because that's what, now, in hindsight, I mean, that can be put down to me being young, me not being taught, but I got to ask the question, how much have I done something similar in my whole life? How much has it been a performance of how I should be? Now, I'm not necessarily critical of this. I'm not saying it is less Muslim or anything of the sort, but that's what I mean. Like, I always felt like I was catching up. It wasn't natural to me.
There's a story. All right. So, like, when I was a bit younger, when I was 10, I went to Kenya, and I was fasting my first Ramadan, and I just finished. I think it was either my first few days, and I really was like, oh, I'm just gonna dig in. It's you know, it's afur, it's iftar time. We're just gonna eat, and then after I finished eating, I didn't realize there was tarawih, right? And so this friend of our family came over and said, let's go, Ahmed. We're gonna go to the mosque and pray tarawih. So we go to the mosque, and we've just prayed Isha.
Right.
And during that, I'm like feeling sick right now. I'm like, my God, I ate too much. And I vomit.
Oh, wow.
In the mosque. Huh. And I'm like, all right, what would a proper, religious, good Muslim boy do at this moment? Yeah. He would continue praying.
Right. Yeah.
Right? So he would continue praying, because, you know, when we're told in this story, I remember there was a story when I was younger that whilst the Sahaba were praying, these men came and they tried to kill them, but they continued praying in the midst of this conflict happening.
Right.
Right. And I'm like, I've got to do that.
Yeah.
This is a conflict. This is my conflict that I'm having, and I'm going to fight against it, and I'm going to pray continually through the vomit, my face upon.
Oh wow.
You know what I mean? Like,
yeah. Yeah.
And then in hindsight, I'm like, why did I do that? Like,
yeah.
My wudu was broken.
Yeah.
One, the mosque is dirty. You're praying in a dirty space right now. Why did I continue?
To borrow from you, part of this, at least for me, was that you took one principle, and that was like kind of a principle of faith, where you understand your religion through kind of a discipline or a determination. And it's a reductive thing, because Islam allows for multiple things you can do in that circumstance. But that's what happens, you know, like I noted in myself as I grew older that every time I wanted to be religious, I just became more conservative. You know, I just became more disciplined, more kind of, I won't use the word hard line, but it was just like less flexible. And this is opposite to the many, many different readings of Islam that I would get later. But it's interesting to trace that my first instinct is to be, you know, unwavering. It's like, you know, to...
Where does it come from?
Look, it could be an Arab upbringing for me. I don't know.
I didn't have an Arab upbringing.
I don't know, but it's a conservative element in my family that sees when you're religious, you are kind of less creative.
Yeah.
You know, you're more...
Whereas that doesn't really make sense, because...
Yeah, I don't want to say this is widespread. Yeah. It's just my experience, but... yeah, absolutely. It doesn't make sense later, but I see it around today.
I see it as well.
In certain pockets that, you know, jokingly, my young son, when he decides he's in a religious space, he will point his finger up at the sky and almost give a frown on his face, because there's a, you know, a level of seriousness that belongs to the deen.
Yeah.
You know, and it's a similar point. So it becomes reductive, however, because, you know, I think Islam encapsulates a kaleidoscope of human emotions and not just a conservative one.
I think it's a particular political moment that we're in as well, and this sort of specific sort of practice of Islam outside of what we deem as home. Like, this idea that you become more, you have to become even more authentic whilst you're away from what you conceive as the home place of whatever you're doing.
Yeah.
Like, for example, I don't know, I think there was a saying, someone said that the Greeks in Australia are more Greek than the Greeks there, because they've held on to this idea or this mythology, right, of what being Greek is, or what being Somali is, or what being Muslim is.
Yeah. A few scholars have written about this, kind of like the paradox of globalization. So what happens is, the more and more our traditions become eroded, the more and more we depart and live in places that are not, quote-unquote, traditionally our home, the more we develop a passion and a desire for the authentic home that we've left behind. And this is what happens when people go back to, be it Egypt, Somalia, Greece, they look for what's been missing. And in my case, you know, I pursued an authentic Islam that was more orientalist than it was, you know.
Talk to me about that.
Well, you know, you grow up here, and the images that you have of the East, of the Muslim world, predominantly...
Because you grew up secular, I want to kind of understand that, really.
Okay, so my family, they didn't teach me my religion. Yeah. They weren't. They were like typically working class ethic of education. You know, be conservative, good to your parents. You know, there was no... Look, we were Muslims. We did Ramadan, you know, maybe, right? Yeah. But, you know, there was no one woke me up for Fajr. No one taught me. I had to teach myself how to pray when I was on my way to uni. Like, I didn't...
What was that feeling of... When you're in this sort of religious space and feel like you weren't knowledgeable, what was that like?
So I had the desire to be Muslim. I had the desire to return.
Yeah, but that But you're obviously in these spaces where you would have to perform this idea of religiosity.
So this
but
is
you
why
didn't have it.
Exactly.
What was that feeling like?
This is exactly why I bring up my grandfather's story at the beginning, because I felt like I was always imitating spaces around me, which is important when you just begin to learn, but you should also be aware of it. Now, it was, in a sense, there is another conflict here that you're...
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot. We charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
Trying to get at, and that is, the more you perform authenticity, there's kind of like this imposter sense of you being an imposter that resides within you, and because you know that you're not that well grounded. Now, there was an additional problem for me, because at the same time I became Muslim, I became political, and I started learning and educating myself at university about the, and I would talk about the political conditions, and that gave me some type of a platform, right? And then my politics was deeply shaped by the Muslim experience in liberal societies. And then suddenly, for whatever reason, people would look at me as if I am speaking from an authentic Islamic position, which wasn't my intention. I was actually asking whether or not liberalism would allow us to return to an authentic, quote-unquote, Muslim expression.
Mm.
And to answer your question then, you always deal with these conflicts and contradictions and these concerns and fears that you're just performing, but at the same time Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala is merciful and you want to return to something that's real, and you, if you believe in it, then it's something that you have to pursue. It's just that I think you always have to be conscious and open and visible to your own location in trying to learn about the deen. The worst is when you think you're a lot further than you are, or you're performing an authority that you don't have a right to perform, or you're expressing a knowledge that you haven't learned. Mm-hmm. That's when it becomes problematic. But simply trying to be is the struggle that we have.
I want to kind of move on to your influences. And one, which is just obvious by the name of your book, is Fanon's Black Skin, White Mask.
Yeah.
And why is Fanon so important?
For two reasons. Fanon changed the way I thought about race, racism, post-coloniality. Changed it. up until then, I was probably a Saidian, Edward Said reader, with certain concerns. But then there's this moment where you read Fanon and you just have to put the book down, because it awakens you to something that you haven't really thought about. It's both in content and form. It's not just the intellectual message. It's the raw voice of his subjectivity, his identity, his sense of self, his location as the author when he speaks. Within the first page, it hits you, right? And then as you unravel it, it becomes this intersection between a discussion about race and racism and coloniality, but also a pursuit of one's own sense of place and voice. Now, I have to be careful, because Fanon is talking about a black-white relation, and he's talking about the feminology, or if you like, the object that is the black body that has been turned and objectified by white racism. I'm not black, right? And in that sense, I have to be careful about what I am borrowing as opposed to what I'm appropriating, what I'm continuing and learning from, as opposed to what I'm erasing. And what I take from my own book, what I took from Fanon through my own book, was really first the form of speaking through a kind of autoethnographic exploration of oneself. So I am my subject matter. I am the object of my own examination. And where I am is the story I wish to tell. That I took, but also the notion that Fanon talks multiple stages, but one of which is the continual pursuit for white recognition, because our subject, our notion of self, is tied to that white recognition. I took that as well. But and then I wanted to ask the question, are Muslims here pursuing a white recognition? Not because, you know, and look, there are black Muslims, there are non-black Muslims, there are an array of various quote-unquote ethnic, quote-unquote racial Muslims. But the pursuit of white recognition here is for a sense of location in history, identity. And, you know, every time a Muslim goes out there and says Islam is peace, jihad means struggle, yada, 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 what is it that we're pursuing? And in many cases, if one borrows from the crucial crux of Fanon's message, is we're pursuing a valid sense of self through the other's white gaze and approval.
Mm. And I guess, what was that journey to Fanon when you first, like you talked about, like, feeling of that first, yeah. Was there a sort of like a resistance to it? Were you afraid of like, because I guess like,
no, I was angry.
You were angry.
I was angry at myself. I was angry at all sorts of things. I was angry at Edward Said. I was angry at the self-indulgent intellectual, forgive me for swearing, wankery that I had spent my entire life talking about concepts and ideas in the pursuit of representation. Because there's a trap in Edward Said's Orientalism, and that trap is that you pursue proper representation. It's not his point, but most people who read it start off thinking, okay, this is how they misrepresent us, this is how they see us, we have to pursue an authentic, correct image of Islam. Fanon brings it back down to the kind of the concrete, right? The here and now, the like the body. And I think, you know, I read how I was pursuing some authentic Islam that was more Orientalist than it was real. Like, go back to my initial comment.
So was, because you're like, I don't know how old you were during that period. Obviously, you've been studying for a period, and you're like, you've sort of fomented your ideas, or you think that you've formated a certain level of self, and what was it like when you realized, no, this is not how it is?
But this is...
What was that like?
This is like, okay, yeah, it happens more often than not, but Fanon was probably the peak moment. I said I was angry, but I was also relieved. And, you know, there's a moment where you just have to accept that you're wrong. I mean, it's not that difficult for me, at least when I...
But it's not about being wrong. It's more in a sense of, like you talked about, you sort of this authentic Islam, and then you based yourself around that.
Well, here's the thing: because you're in exile, I think maybe you're just a little bit freer. Look, yeah, there are consequences, but at the same time,
well, not necessarily consequences in the sense of other people, but more about yourself. Like you're kind of like searching for an ideal version of self, and then you're told there's no such thing.
Yeah, as I said, I was angry because of the time I had. It wasn't like I'd wasted time, because you can't get to certain places without... It wouldn't have been as impactful if I hadn't spent a lot of thought prior to it. I was angry at the fact that I, although was supposedly decolonial, anti-colonial, anti-racist, I had focused so much attention on the privilege of debates about representation.
Sure.
Yeah, and that forecloses, erases, make blind the material coloniality and political structures that racism has created, right? So I became really conscious of my first world location, right? Where I just want you to recognize me for what I am, and that meant multiple things while, you know...
So what do you think Edward Said's actually saying in Orientalist?
He's saying plenty of things, but one of the things that I mean, here's the other thing, just to go back a question, is almost all of my readings are incomplete. They're like, they're abrogated, misappropriated. I put them down, I read them, I return them. I can't remember how many times I've returned to Edward Said and Fanon. You go to other books, you think about it, you sit there, you Facebook, you Twitter, you whatnot, you argue with this person and that person, and you layers, and then you leave stuff behind, you regain things. And then slowly but surely, so my book is really just three readings of Edward Said, which could be argued as three misreadings, three readings of Fanon, and then they intertwine and so forth. So, yeah, so they'd say many things, but it's more important to ask the question what we take out of it. And one of the most common things that we take out of it is oh, look, the West has misrepresented us, constructed us in ways that is convenient. I've created the ideal other. Mm. That's only half the story. And it's not the best half, right? The real crucial questions that come out of Said is, where does one locate themselves when we talk back? What is the critical consciousness that is anti-orientalist? Where is this place of authenticity that we can, you know, these are the real questions that come out of this book. Can we escape a hegemony? The relationship between politics and power is clear, but you could get that anywhere, not just through Said. And then eventually there's a debate about, you know, if you're willing to go that far, is, well, is there an authentic Islam? Or is that in itself
Orientalist? Yeah.
And then that has to be unpacked. What do we mean? Do we mean law? Do we mean the Sharia? Do we mean something ontological? Like, is Islam everything? There's a location? Is it a geography? Then you start asking yourself deeper questions beyond representation. It's no longer about what is the symbolic image of who you are. It's about who you are. And it doesn't have to be static. So to answer your question, it's what we take out of Said that matters. And I think a lot of us have taken the one message at the expense of another.
What do you think people are going to take out of your book?
I don't know. I don't want to know. it was really difficult to write because it's autoethnographic, which means it's a lot about who I am. It's less scientific than one expects, but then there are moments where I become overly theoretical. There are other times where I'm just telling a story. I actually have no idea. I've got good reviews from very big key thinkers around the world, and I'm happy with that, but who knows? I mean, I can only tell you that it was a necessary step for me to take. Before I move on to any other project, I had to write this book.
What's next?
A break. Yeah, look, I wrote this. Yeah, break. I wrote this book in, even though the contract was almost a year, I wrote this book in 6 or 7 weeks. And
love that deadline, don't you?
Yeah, it's like the student who writes the day before. Yeah, and it was partly not because I didn't know the deadline was coming. It's like I spent a lot of time not knowing how to write the book. So most people won't know this, but initially I was supposed to be writing about counter-violent extremism programs. It was about how the government and the state uses post-racial narratives to create moderate Muslims and the starting position that we're all radical, right? And it was about the governmentality of the existing war and terror conversation. But man, I read all the literature on counter-violent extremism and I couldn't do it. It was just so instrumental. So it felt like the Muslim at the heart of this debate, almost every part of us was politicized, and there was this like Western scope, you know, kind of microscopic view of every part of you. Like almost every aspect, every cycle of a Muslim's life was explored and examined for potential traces and clues to help us understand how one becomes radicalized. It really disrupted me, and I just couldn't participate in that vocabulary. I couldn't talk about that. And this is when my Fanonian reading came in, because, you know, the language that we use inevitably is one that really shapes the house of our being and how we engage in it. And I just kept erasing, deleting everything I did. And then one day I was so incredibly frustrated. I did a dua, I wrote Bismillah on the screen. And it takes a certain type of, you know, like, courage, I guess, just to say, you know, I'm not doing this. And then, but I've got a deadline now. Oh my God, I've signed a contract. What's up? And so I just started writing without thinking about what I was writing. And I'm sure each and every one of us have been through this. And all of a sudden, the more truer voice to who you are and what you experience like came out.
And share of consciousness.
Yeah. And then it shaped both style and form. So I don't know if you know this, but my book is very disruptive. It's haphazardous and base. It's not premise, argument, clean chapter. It's snippets of stories here. It's illuminations. There's some anecdote. There's some, you know.
But isn't that right? It's messy.
It's messy. That's exactly what I call it, actually. I call it a messy autoethnography. because my life's messy. And there's no soothing conclusions that I'm trying to pursue here. It's just how I've misread that, misappropriated that, misused that, understood this, come to this. It's really just a story about what we've been discussing. First, I decided I'm not a terrorist, even though you tell me I'm a terrorist. Second, I pursued an authentic Islam, and finally, I didn't find one. So now what, right? And then you conclude, well, the only thing that's left for you is to tell the story that you just told, right? To write about the fact that you cannot write. And that, I hope, explores the confines of the war on terror and how it prevents us from inevitably speaking and pursuing complicated identities.
Thanks, Yasser.
Thanks, Ahmed.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/newsadfree. That's amazon.com/newsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.